This episode of Standard Orbit is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program for the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Walter Koenig, Chekhov from Star Trek, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Risk is our business.
It's like nothing we've dealt with before.
By golly, Jim, I'm beginning to think I can cure a rainy day.
I can't change the laws of physics.
Now in standard orbit, sir.
Welcome, everyone, to Standard Orbit, Trek FM's dedicated podcast that covers the original and new cast of Captain Kirk and the Enterprise. I am Ken Tripp.
And I am Zach Moore, and we have a very exciting interview this week with writer, speaker, and Trekker, Mr. Kevin C. Neese. Kevin is the author of The Gospel According to Star Trek book series, a speaker, and the founder of the Undiscovered Country Project, an ongoing journey through Star Trek from a Christian perspective. Through his blog, audio commentaries, books, and speaking presentations, Kevin poses questions about the spiritual significance of Star Trek as both popular art and a cultural phenomenon. Welcome to the podcast, Kevin.
Thanks very much, guys. Welcome to you, too. It's great to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, so this isn't your first go-around on Trek FM. You were on Matterstream way back in the day.
Yes.
And you're also on Metatrex fairly recently, or maybe not recently. You know, time's not linear here at Trek FM, so I don't really... I don't exactly remember how long ago it was.
It was a few months ago. It was Metatrex 42.
Yeah, it was September.
Okay, right. So it was number Metatrex 42, Making Discoveries. So if you like this interview, which I guarantee you listeners will, go check Kevin out on those podcasts as well.
Yeah. So. And Matterstream 5, which was Religion and Star Trek.
There you go. Matterstream 5,
yeah.
Way back.
Yeah,
so Matterstream 5, time sir. Ago.
What we really want to dive into is your recent book, The Gospel According to Star Trek, The Original Crew, this being the Standard Orbit department of Trek FM, as we talk about the old and new adventures of Captain Kirk and the Enterprise, as we say every week. And that's what your most recent book focuses on. You'll be going through all the crews, but your first book was, of course, for the original series. But before we dive into that, let's talk a little bit about you, your Star Trek fandom, all that good stuff. Like, how did you first discover the show? What are your, like, some of your earliest Star Trek memories, that kind of thing?
Well, my earliest memories of the original series, I recount in the introduction of the book, which is basically kind of liking the concept, but thinking it was kind of dorky, you know, because they had these little wooden blocks that they put into slots, and that I was supposed to believe those were data tapes, and stuff like that. I didn't get into it. I didn't recognize the artistry of the original series for what it was. So when Next Gen came out, I mean, I really became a Next Gen kid. And then in probably the early 90s, about 1991 was when I really got into the original crew movies. And that was really where I came to love the original crew, was through those films. So my Star Trek for the longest time was really Next Gen and original crew movies. And then it was later that I got into everything else, including the original series and the animated series, both of which are in the book and both of which I love.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, I much the same as you. I grew up watching the Next Generation and the original series movies. So that was my window into TOS as well. So when I think of the original series, I think of, you know, the Star Trek movies, you know, 1 through 6. And then it's like, oh, and there's all these other episodes of TV that came before that too.
Right.
So with all that in mind, Kevin, your Star Trek fandom, how did the Undiscovered Country Project come about, and, you know, the book as well, your new book series? How did those spring from your Star Trek fandom?
So it was kind of weird because you know, you and I came to Star Trek about the same era, I think, or similarly, I guess. And I got to a point where, you know, it was where you had the three series on television and I had fallen behind on some of them. And of course, we didn't have DVRs and stuff. And I tried to watch things in order because I'm just that way. And I just kind of got out of sync with Star Trek and just kind of dropped out of watching it for a while because I was like, oh, I'll have to catch it, you know, when I can watch everything the way I want to because I'm a purist that way. And and so I was only going to see the movies. And then I went to see Insurrection and started questioning going to see the movies because it was just like, oh, man, wow. But I wanted to see Nemesis, but I never got around to it. But so
well,
I kind
of
had
this... That's evidence in itself. Yeah, itself. Just, your lack of seeing kind of... Nemesis in the theater. Well done, Insurrection. You lost
Yeah, right. Exactly. And so so there was kind of these fallow years where I just wasn't into Star Trek. But during that time, I mean, it was into Star Trek, you know. But I just wasn't watching it, you know, like I used to. And so during that time, I underwent what I call my worldview conversion process, which is that, you know, I went to college, which I wasn't originally going to do. But I got a scholarship from my wife's granddad, who gave scholarships to all of his grandkids and lots of other people. And I decided to just go to get a degree to hang on the wall to get a better job, like in video production and film. And then I saw that there was an intro to philosophy class, and I was interested in that. We were doing some of that in the church leadership team. We were talking about philosophy and theology and all that stuff. So I said, well, I'll take that. That'll be fun. And the first day of that class, it changed my whole perspective on what I was doing, you know, why I was getting an education, and that my intellectual pursuits were necessarily spiritual pursuits, and that my my faith was not separate from the rest of my life, but that it was integral to everything that I did. And I immediately went to my advisor and changed my major. And it was from that process of kind of starting to exercise those muscles and begin to look at the world in a different way that I came back to Star Trek. And when I came back to Star Trek, it was to write a paper. I got excited about Star Trek because I did finally see Nemesis and on DVD and probably liked it more than I should have, but the good parts of Nemesis are really good. And I got really excited and started watching it and decided I wanted to do a paper on Data for this conference that I did at my university every year. And the paper on Data, as I was doing research for it, I started watching Next Generation, and then the Abrams film was coming out, so I started watching the original series, went to see the Abrams film, and I started realizing that the things, it wasn't just Data. You know, there was stuff all over Next Generation that was resonating with and even deepening my faith and enriching my faith life. And then I realized, well, it's all over Star Trek. And so by the time I wrote the paper was on Star Trek as a whole. And as soon as I'd had the paper, I knew it was going to be a book. And that was back in 2008, 2009, presented the paper in 2009. So I've been going since then. And the book just was just a natural outgrowth of that. And then as I got into the book, it became a series. So that's where we're at.
So by the time, let's see, you have, obviously you have the original series. You're going to have Next Gen, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, Enterprise are all going to have their own books.
That's correct.
Awesome. Yes. And then Discovery, I guess, by the time you're done with these.
Yeah, I don't know. We're going to have to see about that. You know, if it lasts 12 episodes, then maybe not.
A brief addendum at the end of the Enterprise book, perhaps.
Right, yeah. That's what we'll do. We'll do a revised and expanded edition of the Enterprise book with Discovery at the end.
For sure. That's, well, you know, the one we're going to hone in on today is the only one that's been released so far. It's The Gospel According to Star Trek, The Original Crew. And it covers a lot of different angles to religion and Christianity in Star Trek. And, you know, to me, one of the most interesting parts of the book was the first section dealing with Gene Roddenberry, because he's often labeled as an atheist. And that's not the most accurate description of his worldview, is it, Kevin?
Yeah, actually, it's not. It's a common misconception that he was an atheist. And certainly he did not believe in a personal God, that is a God who is a person, who is somebody that we would worship. But he believed in a form of pantheism, really. And pantheism really is the belief. Pantheism proper is the belief that everything is God. But I think his idea of the divine was more limited to human beings and perhaps other intelligent creatures, which I assume, you know, would include alien life, or I don't know, maybe it included dolphins. I don't really know, or apes. I don't really know. He didn't clarify. But I spent a long time, because I went into the book, assuming that Roddenberry was an atheist, and then started actually reading his words and hearing what he was saying, and said, wow, for an atheist, this guy talks about God an awful lot. The thing that I say in the book is that, you know, atheism, there are shades of atheism, but the essential of it is that it just breaks down to the Greek theos for God, and a or a, which means no, no God. So the atheist belief is that there is no God. So if somebody has a belief about God or ascribes traits to God other than non-existence, you know, that person is categorically not an atheist, because the only thing an atheist believes about God is that God doesn't exist. Gene Roddenberry had a lot of things to say about God, not one of which was that God didn't exist. So that's something that was kind of a revelation for me, and something that I spent a long time on that section of the book, because I wanted to be sure that I said it, that I represented him as accurately as I could, and that I had done enough research and had wrestled with it long enough to make sure that I was presenting it accurately. So, yeah, those four chapters are about a year of my life.
So, no, a year well spent, because I think it shed a light on a part of his life that a lot of people misinterpret or aren't really aware of, you know, and he even, you know, and all the quotes that people will sometimes take out of context, he's really calling out, you know, false prophets and charlatans, and like for good reason, you know, like across the world, any organization, any kind of thing like that, that exists. And that's an unfortunate, you know, reality of religion, organized religion. And, you know, he's frustrated with it, and he was calling it out. And, you know, it's as you should, right?
Right. And I would say that he probably had a limited amount of religion that he saw that he would think was beneficial if there was any. He was very much against organized religion as a thing, and but he wasn't. He talked about not really thinking that it should be banned, you know, or gotten rid of, but that his hope would be that as humankind matured, it would sort of fall out of fashion, and I think the disconnect that he saw, because I think he said some things I think that showed some respect for Jesus and for his values and for his teachings. And particularly, I talk about the episode Bread and Circuses in the book. I think that episode is often misrepresented, and that actually the Christian thread in that episode is really the point of the episode, just looking at the way the thing's written. People try to make it about television and other things, and yeah, that's there, but that's window dressing compared to the actual narrative of the story. And there's a lot, and I also talk about Return of the Archons, there's a lot of stuff in Star Trek where there's respect for the teaching that spawned the religion, but there's heavy criticism for how the religion has sort of drained people of their humanity, has worked against the health and life of the spirit. And that is not in any sense an inaccurate criticism of religion. Particularly as we've seen in the West, certainly there is life-giving religion. Certainly there is healthy and good religion, but sometimes it can be hard to find and hard to see, and so I think the criticisms that Gene and other and the writers of Star Trek in general made about religion are usually, for me as a Christian, or I see those as instructive, important to listen to and to hear and to understand, because if that's the impression people have of what it means to be a religious person, or particularly to be a Christian, then we're probably doing something wrong.
Yes, you know, it's interesting, Kevin, because as I was listening to what you were saying and paying very close attention to what you were saying, you know, I was doing my own research into you, your books, and the things that you say and you wrote, and it struck me. Because, you know, part of your speaking engagements and what you're talking about out there, you said that by showing the connection between Star Trek's humanistic worldview and a Christian, right, helps, it was interesting, helps redeem the Christian view of humanity. And I underlined that, when I heard that, you know, I wrote down my question to you is, what is in need of redemption? And in many ways, you kind of alluded to it, but I'm wondering if we could kind of circle back to that a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of times, and a lot of this has to do with the way Christian religion has sort of propagated, particularly in the United States, because it's very much about confronting people with their sin, confronting people with their failures and with the brokenness in their life, and saying, you know, we all need fixing, you know. And that's not wrong. You know, we do all need fixing. That's what we spend our whole lives trying to do, is become a better version of ourselves. But I think a lot of times that focus has tended to end up with sort of a denigration of humanity itself, because we see its failures more than we see its goodness. We've lost this this traditional Christian concept of the imago Dei, that is the image of God, so that we're created in the image of God, the image and likeness of God, no matter how fractured or broken or marred it is, it's still there, and there's still goodness in us, and we do have, as Gene Roddenberry said, a lot of things to be proud of as human beings. And what I saw as a Christian Star Trek fan was that humanism was really viewed as kind of the enemy of Christianity, which is ridiculous, because there's a long tradition of Christian humanists, people who recognized that if humanity is the imago Dei, if it is the expression of the image of God, at least the best parts of it, then as we explore deeply what it means to be human, we ought to be bumping up against the gospel. And I think we find that happening a lot in Star Trek. And what I would see as a Christian Star Trek fan was, Christians would look at Star Trek and they say, oh, okay, well, that's humanistic. And therefore, they would either dismiss it out of hand because they could put a label on it that said not Christian, and so they didn't want to have anything to do with it, or they would just feel guilty for liking it. And I felt like, no, you know what? There's a reason we like this, and it's not bad. There's a good thing here. One of the things that we say in the circles that I'm a part of, one of the things that we've circulated a lot, is that all goodness is God's goodness. All truth is God's truth. All beauty is God's beauty. And we borrow this quotation from Abraham Kuyper that says, that there is not one square inch of creation over which Christ does not call mine. So everything belongs to God. Everything goes back to God. And God is telling his story through everything. And wherever we find goodness, wherever we find truth, wherever we find beauty, we're finding the things of God. And it's not inconceivable that we could find those in the humanity that he called very good at its creation.
That is an excellent point, Kevin, because I really honed in on that myself, and I was reading your book, and you were explaining that the kind of contradiction as like a Star Trek fan who's a Christian. You're like, oh, well, they're talking about humanism here and they're celebrating that, but we're talking about, you know, man has fallen in need of redemption. But I mean, there is a middle ground there. Like you said, we are created in the image of God, so that doesn't mean it's bad to talk about all the great things we can accomplish together. And yeah, it's crazy, because I don't know what it is, but you have that, there is that conflict with perhaps the perceived value system of Star Trek and the perceived value system of Christianity, when you're trying to marry the two, and you're like, oh, should I celebrate this? I don't know. You know, so I completely related to what you were talking about there.
Well, that's great. I'm always glad to hear that someone has related to something I'm saying and writing, because that's why I write it. That's why I share it, is so that other people can have some sense of recognition. And also too, so that there's a voice out there saying that Christianity is not about divorcing ourselves from our humanity, that it's about the fullest expression of our humanity and a full, robust engagement with the world in which we live, not an isolation from or battle with it. You know, that culture is a conversation, not a confrontation. And I think that's something that not a lot of people hear. So I recommend my book to non-Star Trek fans, because there's a lot in it that you don't have to know anything about Star Trek to engage with. I have a thing on my website called that you can download for free, called the Non-Trekkies Reading Guide for the book. I've thought I need to try to figure out how to make a non-Christians reading guide, but I'm not sure exactly how to do that. But I feel like that if somebody isn't a Christian, and I've had people who aren't Christians read the book or engage with, come and listen to me speak, and they can still find value in what I'm saying, and they're fascinated to hear the viewpoint. I've found a lot of different, very open-minded people in the Star Trek community, and I love that dialogue, and I love being able to show somebody that that being a Christian doesn't mean what a lot of people think it does, and that it's really about being a good human being, or a better human being, trying to be.
So getting into TOS a little bit more, and thank you, first of all, for answering that, because it was a great way to... Yeah, like I said, it was a fascinating word, redeem, and that's why I wanted to go down that path a little bit, and I think we'll circle back into it, because you've hit on some of this already when we talk about TOS proper. You've already hit on a couple of episodes, especially Bread and Circuses, which I agree with you. I thought that was pretty much on the nose as to what it was focused on, and what it was getting at. You know, that faith and that focus and that unwillingness to compromise one's beliefs, and then it all comes out, and it's very clear in the end where that's coming from. So yeah, there's very little ambiguity, I thought, in that episode at all.
And I'll just say too, people who think that was just sneaked by Gene, people who think that was something that the writers did is like, oh good, you know, Gene didn't notice. Baloney. That is not true. Not only was Gene Roddenberry signing off on every single episode, he was rewriting the majority of them. And in fact, the book, These Are the Voyages, even says that some of what they term the more sentimental, Mark Cushman terms some of the more sentimental dialogue in that episode, which I would say was probably that ending scene about it's not the Son of the Sky, it's the Son of God, that actually came from Gene, and that Gene introduced those elements into it. I don't know if it's that particular scene, but whether he wrote that or rewrote it or what, that's got Gene Roddenberry's stamp of approval, and don't let anybody tell you otherwise. And look at what he's approving. He's not approving organized religion. He's approving that Jesus taught things that we teach and we believe here in Star Trek as well. And that's a cool thing. Sorry, I didn't mean to derail you, but...
Well, no, all it does is illustrate the point even more so, and it kind of brings... Because it's funny, so we all have our lens on things, and we take away... And what was interesting to me... We'll stick with that episode for a second, and I'm going to go down a different path, but we'll see how it comes back up again, is that the two leading stars were both Jewish. And, you know, and this is 1960s television. You know, everything had its kind of, you had to be careful with censors and whatnot. And I guess they were probably a little bit more, quote unquote, Christian values. I don't know if, or Christian Judeo values that were, ensured that they were given their due in those timelines. Obviously, they weren't allowed to stray or say certain words. And, you know, even though the dress in those days was pretty provocative for its time, you know, there was certainly certain things to follow. So I wasn't surprised that an episode like that could get through. I was just always curious what those two actors thought about that episode. I've never found anything or read anything that feeds back to it. And I know we're talking about Gene Roddenberry, it's his creation. But what an interesting thing. And that to me is the ultimate IDIC. Because they actually talked about something that the two lead actors, in theory, as far as we know, didn't believe in. I don't know if that's true or not.
But right. And fascinating, you know, to me. One of the things that didn't make it into the book that I wish had, I didn't really figure out a way to work it in, and maybe I should have. I actually did an interview with Ralph Senensky, who directed that episode. He's 92 now, I think, 93. He was, I think, 91 at the time. And I asked him specifically about that. I was like, where does this come from? How do you guys, you know, deal with this? And he's like, look, all of us are there to do a job. And the actors, just like everybody else, they're just there to do the job, to say the lines that are on the page, deliver them as well as they can. And he's like, as far as whatever their religion is, whatever their worldview is, whatever, they just kind of package that up and set it aside and do whatever they have to do to serve the characters in the story. And I thought that was a really interesting perspective from him. That, you know, he's like, he wasn't personally, because he's Jewish too, and he wasn't personally trying to say anything, you know, pro-Christian or whatever in the episode. And certainly, most of the writers and a lot of the people were Jewish as well. And so they weren't trying to push that. And again, I don't think Gene would necessarily be trying to push Christianity proper either. I think that's really antithetical to his makeup and to his philosophy to do that. But yeah, it is interesting to watch that scene and knowing that Leonard and Bill at least are both Jewish and to watch them talking so favorably about Jesus. It's an odd thing to look at.
It is, but I didn't take it as being, you know, that they were proselytizing or anything on that episode.
No,
I looked at it as, you know, it's a duplicate Earth, and this is part of Earth history,
right?
And this thing evolved, and this thing happened.
Absolutely.
And that's how I captured it. But it still fascinated me, and mm-hmm. and those are two actors that are not afraid to speak up.
That's right. That's right.
Because there was a lot of turmoil on that set. Mm-hmm. And when things were written in a direction that went against the character, not
yes.
necessarily their own beliefs, but their character,
right.
They would speak up quite
That's
often,
right.
actually. Yeah.
That's very right. And of course, Leonard did a lot to intentionally bring Jewish influences into Spock and into the series. And I have friends who are much more articulate on that than I, who I love talking with. People like Jonathan Gershom, who wrote Jewish themes in Star Trek, and a lady called Leslie Owen, who I got to talk to and really get to know recently when I was I was a guest in Atlanta at Treklanta earlier this year. Just really, really thoughtful engagement with the Jewish background of the writers and the directors and everybody behind it, and what a strong influence that is on the series. So that's great. I think a lot of people would kind of say it's got to be one or the other. It's got to be either or. It's got to be humanism or Christianity, or it's got to be Judaism or Christianity. But when I see the humanistic stuff, when I see the Jewish stuff, all that does is just inform my Christian interpretation and make it deeper and more interesting and more exciting, because they bring out colors and ideas that I never would have known before, and it's beautiful. Love the dialogue.
Yeah, you mentioned Return of the Archons earlier, and I think that's an episode that is, like most of Star Trek, and that's why it's so universally popular, is it is what you bring to it, right? As someone who's anti-religion period, it's like, well, clearly this is an indoctrination of, you know, organized religion and how messed up it is and how it brainwashes you and you're part of this body and all this stuff, and it's very weird traditions that people do now, but it's we're past that. That's barbaric, you know. But if you come to it from a different point of view, you're like, you know what, think when you are part of your religion, don't shake your brain at the door, you know. This is ceremonialism.
Yep.
Taken to the extreme, and that is not right. So I think no matter what your worldview is, you can come to all these particular stories and Star Trek as a whole, and it doesn't necessarily conflict with what you're saying. You just see, like, oh, yeah, you will agree with it no matter what. You're like, yeah, you tell them Star Trek, no matter what your point of view is. Right.
Return of the Archons was one of the episodes that I use as kind of an archetype so that I could talk about how the original series dealt with religion kind of overall through the lens of that episode. Because that episode, I thought, was kind of primal in that process. And it also, I felt, was really easy to relate directly to Christianity, particularly because of some of the language and some of the culture trappings and things like that. And I love that episode...
Out of the body, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, the body, exactly. So, and people have said that, well, that, you know, that's just, you know, anti-Christian or whatever, but I felt like, you know, that can be anti-religious, and there's a difference between, because you notice that nobody questions that Landru gave them good teachings. Nobody questions that Landru was wise. Nobody questioned that Landru was a helpful and a healing and a salvific influence. But what they do say is that the religion that has been built in his name is damaging. And that is so frequently true. And if that's not something that Christians can admit to themselves and to others and try to work on, then they're missing kind of the point, you know.
Right. I mean, I always saw it as more anti-puritanical. I mean,
yeah.
Even down to the costumes. I don't know if that's just because those are the costumes they had access to in the 60s, but
right.
That's the way the planet was presented to us, right?
So. Right. That's one of those things, too, where that's one way to read it. That's one way to read it. Or at least, let's say... it's against a legalistic form of religion. And it's also, I would say this, and I didn't really say this specifically in these words in the book, but it occurs to me now, that the critique here is often against the worship of religion. That when our focus shifts so that the religious quote unquote things that we do are not tools for us to deepen our faith and our understanding of God and our relationship with other human beings, and they themselves become the things, the church becomes the authority, the church becomes what we're defending and what we're all about, or the whatever the various thing is, especially because so often so much of that gets co-opted by politics and by personal quests for power and things of that nature. It gets corrupted so easily that when those things can become an idol, essentially, and they can cause us to miss the point of why we started doing this stuff to begin with. And once that happens, then we've got to rework what we're doing.
Right. Yeah, I've heard it said in other examinations of Star Trek and religion that you could interpret the Enterprise, going around just calling out and destroying false gods, right? I mean, you have Vol, you have Landru, you have Apollo, that's one way to look at it, right? And so that's a theme that continues, the originals. It continues through Star Trek, really, because, as you mentioned in the book, Gene Roddenberry just seems to hone in on this god figure, right? And David Gerald himself was like, has said, like, when they run out of ideas, like, oh, have him meet God.
Right. Yeah.
And it's either a kid or a computer, right? So.
Right. Yeah. So, like, whenever Gene didn't know what to do, he'd have Kirk fight God, which is really true, and it's interesting because I don't know if that's recognized for what it, I relate it to, an idea that's very strong in a lot of Christian traditions, which is iconoclasm, which is, like you say, the tearing down of false gods. And the tearing down of a false god isn't necessarily saying there's no god. It just means that false god you tore down is not God. That conception of God does not reflect whatever God may or may not be. And I think that's an important thing to do. It's a very important thing to do. And it's something that a lot of Christians really value and should continue to value.
Now, I appreciated in the book that you talked about the animated series, and we've been talking about God a lot, and let's talk about the devil of Magus 2. What an insane episode, just regardless. But then you literally have Spock drawing a pentagram on the floor. It's like, what is this? So yep. Just give us a little bit of taste of what your whole take on that was and what they were trying to say with that episode, where they meet quote-unquote Lucian, who they reveal his true name is Lucifer. Like, I'm not even sure what they're trying to say, really. And I liked your examination of it, so why don't you share some of that with the listeners here?
Well, for me, that episode is, it was particularly puzzling for me for a while. It was just kind of one of those episodes that I went, okay, we're clearly trying to talk about something here, but I'm not sure exactly what we're trying to talk about.
Right. What's your angle here?
But it was really interesting because I started doing some research and I just started looking up, like, there's a character called Asmodeus. And I was like, well, let me find out who Asmodeus is and where he comes from or whatever. And so I started doing some research. And I find out that Asmodeus is this character who is mentioned in this book called The Magus. And particularly in The Magus, Book 2. And this is this book all about, witchcraft and I was like, wait a minute, what? And I thought, wait a minute, The Magus Book 2, maybe that, and I don't have any documentation of this, just my research, but I was like, that seems to be that The Magus Book 2 became the planet of Magus 2 in the series. And then there's another thing with Lucian, who is this character who's not a Lucifer character, but is this person who does who acts kind of as a lawyer and it's very interesting to watch all these kind of weird threads being hinted at and being connected in this thing. But when you talk about Spock drawing a pentacle on the floor of the Enterprise, Yeah, that's freaky because, I think one of the reasons it's freaky is it's one of the few times in Star Trek, very few times in Star Trek, where there's a very specific religious symbol that is represented, an Earth religious symbol that is represented. There's a Balance of Terror where you have, you know, maybe what looks vaguely like a cross on the wall, you know, in the chapel along with some other symbols, and you have a character in the original series who wears a bindi. You know, the little dot on the forehead from the Hindu faith, and various things like that. But particularly in that era, I mean, to have Spock doing that. But the thing that he's saying is, you know, here this is perfectly logical. Here this makes sense. I should be able to move things with my mind in this reality, because that's how things work here, and it's not. I think the unusual, maybe the reason they went that direction, maybe the thing they were looking for was that they were trying to find a way where all of this stuff that is usually written off can somehow be real. And then it's a question of, is that real, and what's our relationship to it? I put it this way in the book. I said, "Did Kirk save Lucifer?" Because the whole thing at the end is McCoy asks Kirk, "Do you think Lucian really was the demon some men call Lucifer?" And Kirk said, "Does it really matter?" And Spock says, "It just might, Captain. If he was, this would be the second time Lucifer was cast out, and thanks to you, the first time he was saved," which I thought was really interesting. Kind of a callback to the apple there a little bit. We just gave them the apple. And so I said, did Kirk save Lucifer? Is that even possible?
Yeah, that ending, right? I remember the first time I even came across this episode, I was at a Star Trek convention with my mom, and we just watched it, and she was like, I don't know about that. Like, yeah, I don't know either, Mom. That's really weird.
This is a little weird. So for me, what I said in the book is that it's highly unlikely that, you know, this really is Lucifer, but the implications addressed here are more for effect than message. So the challenge of the sympathy for the devil shown in Magics of Magus 2 is less about kindness to the person of Lucifer himself and more about kindness to the devils we make of others in our world. I go to some length in the chapter to talk about the real Salem witch trials, because there's a parallel there with the Salem witch trials. And I talk about, it's very similar actually to what they say in the episode. What they say in the episode is, we weren't trying to harm anybody, we were just being ourselves, and we just happened to be magical beings, and they burned us as witches. The real truth of that is that the people who died in Salem were most likely not involved in any occult stuff, and most likely probably Christians, who were targeted because they were undesirables, because of conflicts over land interests and other things like that. And it's just a terrible, terrible, tragic thing. And witchcraft was just sort of this thing that was used against them. So it's about the kindness to the devils we make of others in our world through misunderstanding, self-righteousness, ignorance, and fear. And when we come to know the feared other as our fellow human and neighbor, we can see, instead of a broad caricature or abstraction, a person made in the image of God, needing to be loved, whether we may deem them worthy or not. In these instances, it will do us good to have the humility to recall our own unworthiness, knowing that we can learn and grow from our mistakes, as well as that we still have much to learn, much learning and growing to do, can help us to find the compassion that convinces the Megans to no longer fear humanity. That same compassion is the key by which we learn to no longer fear one another. And so I really felt like it was, the episode is sort of exploring the possibilities and asking these questions about, you know, well, it was supposed to be one of these, you know, the Enterprise meets God in space episodes. And it, for some reason, it came back that we couldn't do God, but we could do the devil. And so they just kind of went down that road. And why, I don't know. That seems to be sort of a thing that's been lost to history. But for me, the episode is very much about fear. and about the Magans sort of putting it to the crew of the Enterprise by making them the victims, by putting them in the stocks, you know, and saying, here's what it is to be a victim of fear, you know, here's what it is to be the other. Can we push you hard enough that you will repay like for like? Can we put you in a position where you will respond to us in fear and in hatred? And the challenge that Kirk faces is not giving into that and trying to stand up to them, you know, when they're trying to destroy them, because not because he wants to destroy them, but because he says, if you do this, if you lash out at Lucien and punish him and give him something worse than the death sentence, which is isolation, you know, if you do that to him, you'll be as bad as the people who burned the witches in Salem, because you'll be acting in that same fear. So he's not just trying to protect his crew. He's not just trying to protect this being, Lucien, whoever he is. He's fighting for a being because they're a being, because they exist, because they have a life, and because they deserve to have a life. And he's also fighting for those who are at least saying, I mean, we find out later it's all a ruse, but they're saying that they're trying to hurt him. So even the oppressors, he's saying, no, 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 you guys can be better than this. I want to rescue him, but I also want to rescue you, you know, from going down this road. And at the same time, I'm trying to rescue myself from going down that road. So it's about lifting us all up out of that and fight. And I think that translates, like, all of the stuff with aliens and Star Trek. I mean, we can relate that directly to just varieties of human beings. And recognizing that here the crew of the Enterprise is possibly, you know, defending Lucifer. And I think the idea there is, can you think of a more, you know, a more reviled sort of mythological being, if you're looking at it from their point of view? Or can you think of someone who is less defensible, right? And so let's look at our own world and look at the person who we may perceive as being so much against us or so much opposed to our beliefs, or so much someone of whom we disapprove in one way or another. And can we bring ourselves to overcome our fear of that person so that we don't become the oppressor and we lift them up? And can we, even as we see others being oppressed, can we deal with those people who are doing the oppressing also without falling into the trap of fear? That's a really, really complex thing to coordinate, and we all have to work on it. So, weirdly, this bizarre little animated episode about a man with goat legs, you know, who makes magic, you know, in the weird backwards part of the universe, can help us think about those things.
There's a lot of things to reflect on into what you're saying, because it's pretty powerful stuff. Even though the genesis of it was, like you said, quite a wild episode, but it's transition time. We're going to go beyond the TAS and go into, actually, as you started off the podcast saying, you know, the movie era. I don't know if you said it was your favorite era, but it was definitely up there with TNG. And for us, I think as Zach and Tony Black had said so well in 165, Star Trek at its best. I do agree with that. I think this was the best era of Star Trek. But getting into the movies, I mean, they are rich with themes of life, death, sacrifice, resurrection, searching for the creator for the second time. Because you were more familiar with these, or this is where your jumping off point into TOS was, were they easier to analyze through this because of that, or was there more of a challenge to find a fresh take? What do you think there?
It kind of altered, it kind of varied from film to film, because each of them sort of... you know, the motion picture is really its kind of own little universe, its own little version of the Star Trek universe that you just don't find anywhere else. I mean, there's comic strips and comic books and things like that, but in terms of film and television, it's an era of Star Trek that is unto itself, you know. And then 2, 3, and 4 have an arc, you know. And I talk in those films, and this is something that I didn't see till much later, until I had already seen Data as a Christ figure, when I saw Spock as a Christ figure in those films. And for the longest time, I only saw it in 2 and 3, and hadn't even noticed it in 4 until one day I'd watched 2 and 3 and went to 4 and just to finish the story out and said, oh my goodness, Spock's Jesus in this movie too. And so those, and then 5, you know, you deal directly with a quest for God, you know, and then 6, you're talking about, again, this, this fear of the other and the process toward peace and the uncertainty of the future and all those sorts of, and ingrained, ingrained biases and prejudices and how they can sneak in, you know, even to the best people, even to the Captain Enterprise. So, you know, it's one of those things where, in a certain sense, it is easier because a film or a series of films or whatever, they're kind of, they exist in their own space and they tell their own story and you can deal with them in a pretty isolated way, much the way you would deal with an episode of a television series. But it's, it can sometimes be harder to kind of pull together a large theme from a lot of episodes, you know, and kind of lace it together and make a thing out of it. So in a certain sense, yeah, I mean, it's a little bit finite, you know, it's like, I know I have 2,000 to 4,000 words that I have to do just on this film, you know, and I can dive deep and there's special features and audio commentaries and all kinds of stuff that you don't necessarily have, you know, on an episode. So, so yeah, there were certain parts of it that were easier and there were certain things that, that were challenging, particularly as I got into the later movies, the Kelvin timeline movies, there were certain things that were challenging, but it was fun. It was an exciting thing to get into each one of them.
I know for me, Kevin, I was particularly impressed by your take on Star Trek IV, which, like you, on first glance, I thought would be light on the spiritual parallels, but then at the end, where Spock says, "I stand with my shipmate," you're like, "Oh, Jesus stands accused." It blew my mind to making that connection. It makes perfect sense, you know, and that it continued, you know, death and resurrection arc that Spock has as the Christ figure, and then he brings salvation to Earth, you know, descending from the clouds. I mean, it's like, oh, yeah. It's all there if you really look at it. So it's just crazy. It really did blow my mind to connect those dots, because you, on first glance, it does stop at 2 and 3. Like, okay, he died, he saved everyone, he's back, but it continues on to 4.
Yeah, and that's the thing is that, you know, we had done audio commentaries actually on Star Trek 2 and 3, and I think we'd done 2 and 3 at that point. And so I had done tons of research on these movies and everything, but one day I just decided, man, I just want to watch Star Trek 2 for the fun of it. I just miss watching Star Trek and not taking notes, you know, let me just do it. And I watched it and then suddenly realized that it was Palm Sunday and I texted my friends. I was like, oh, hey, it's no wonder that it's Palm Sunday. It's no wonder I would want to watch a Jesus movie, because I just had the strong surge to watch Star Trek 2. And then I said, well, you know, we'll continue it with Star Trek 3. And I knew that movie pretty well. And I did take some notes. But Star Trek 3, again, a lot of biblical parallels. They're kind of jumbled up. I say it's a little bit like scripture jazz. And there's a number of different themes going on in there that you can read. Again, none of this intentional. I want to make that very clear. None of this is anything that I can find record that anybody intended to put in these movies. But once you see it, it's hard to unsee it. And the depth and the breadth of this stuff, the details that would jump out at me were just, were killing me. You know, it wasn't anything that I went looking for. It found me. And particularly when I got to Star Trek IV, because I was just like, oh, you know, I'm just going to put this movie in to finish the series. And it surprised the heck out of me, how much I saw, you know, this parallel where, you know, humankind is about to die and the earth is about to die because of the failures of humankind, because of the sins of humankind. And here is, you know, Spock. There's so much to that.
I did a whole just read the book, guys. Just read the book.
Read the book. I did a whole presentation on this arc. And it's just there's so much in it.
Yeah, no, for sure. Because I think you immediately gravitate towards, the motion picture, because, you know, you're searching for the creator. We all create God in our own image, right? I mean, that's, I forget what lines are in the director's edition, what lines are in the theatrical cut. But as Spock says, like, we all turn to someone in our lives, a father, a brother, a God, why am I here? Like, that's like deep, you know, reflective stuff that, you know, and it ties into that whole, you know, search for a higher power and something greater than yourself and wanting to be in communion with it. So that's pretty obvious. And then 5, I mean, you're literally searching for God.
And again, it's you know, in that chapter, you know, I didn't, I primarily focused on that last scene, that confrontation with the God being, and it's again, it's Star Trek engaging in iconoclasm and in a pretty detailed way, and it ends up that, you know, all the things that they say, they basically put down criteria for who and what God should be, and how this being doesn't meet those, and all those criteria really reflect God as he's represented in the Bible, so.
I think in these times where so many acts of just terrorism and horror committed in the name of religion, I think, you know, that scene with McCoy and the quote-unquote God figure there, where he says, "Do you doubt me?" He's like, "Well, I doubt any God who inflicts pain for his own pleasure. Right? It's like, that is it, man. That is it right there. That just undercuts all this BS that we go through with people doing horrible things in the name of God or any higher power. And it's not what it's all about, man.
No, it's not, and it's exciting too to then, you know, to move from those things, because six is kind of this sort of outlier in that sense, because it doesn't have that element quite so much. I mean, there are references to Eden and things like that, but I mean, it's easy to talk about Star Trek and religion when they're dealing directly with religion, or when there's a Christ figure parallel, or when they're talking about a quest for creator or something greater than ourselves and things like that. It's easy to sort of get into that, but when you get into Star Trek VI and it's about politics, you know, and our relationship with Russia, and it's like, wait a minute. But, you know, but then you realize that, I mean,
who knew how topical that would be these days, by the way?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I know. Because it has so much to do with the fear of the other and how we can, you know, I think Kirk feels justified in his distaste for, let's put it mildly, for the Klingons. Kirk feels justified in that, not just because of the relationship that the Federation has had with them heretofore, but also because of the personal hurt and the personal tragedy and loss. And I think there are lots of times when, and I see this particularly amongst Christians, or at least it stands out to me amongst Christians, but I see it a lot of places, where we feel justified in speaking against people because they don't reflect our beliefs, or they don't meet our standards, or whatever it is that we think it is, or they deviate from our idea of what they should be doing, or how they should be living, or what they should be saying. And we can, you know, we can let that. I think it's great. People get upset that Kirk is so prejudiced in this movie, but I think it's great that he is, because it's great to show that this captain of the Enterprise isn't a paragon. You know, as Eve says in Mudd's Women, you know, the captain is supposed to be a paragon, and I never met a paragon. You know, and I think she's messing with him there, but she's right.
And, Eve, another biblical reference.
I know. Oh yeah, they're all over. Particularly when it comes to Eden and Genesis and all that, it's all over right. The original series and everywhere. But we can see how that prejudice sort of creeps into his heart, and all of that, all of how he has to come to the place of forgiveness, how he has to come to view his enemy differently. You know, there's a song by a guy called Derek Webb called "My Enemies Are Men Like Me." You know, the idea that the people we hate, you know, well, they're human beings too, and they have the same desire to be loved and the same struggles and everything that we do. And having to push through all that hurt and push through all that pain and stop othering and start one anothering. That's about neighbor love. That's about what it means to love our neighbor and to love them as ourselves. And in fact, the inscription of this book is a quotation from David Gerrold, which is something he said to me in an email, and he didn't even remember saying it. I met him recently and showed it to him, and he was like, "Oh wow, that's a pretty good quote. I didn't know I said that." I'm like, "Oh yeah, you did." But he said the primary philosophy in Star Trek, stripped of everything else, was love one another. I think Jesus might have said something like that once too. And so we see in Star Trek VI and in so many other places that that concept of neighbor love coming back and challenging us again, because I think a lot of people would say, well, that's not religion, that's politics. Well, no, it's not religion. you know, but religion, as we talked about earlier, you know, faith, spirituality, being a Christian, it's not limited to religion. And the minute we do that is when we lose the point. There's no separation. And politics is how part of how we live as human beings, and that makes it important.
Well, all heavy stuff there, Kevin. I recommend everybody get the book, read it. This goes into very much depth in all these topics. But, you know, to kind of round out our discussion here, let's get into the Kelvin timeline. So your analogy of Spock Prime as a god figure influencing events, but still making Kirk and Spock forge their own destiny together, was a brilliant way of looking at the predestination free will debate. Because I feel like that's always something that I've, you know, made that explanation, you know, just my limited human mind can't wrap my head around the fact that God is, you know, omniscient, omnipresent, you know, can see the past, present, and future, right? But it's like, if he knows what's going to happen, he's just going to put things in place, and then you have to play it out. I mean, he knows the end. It doesn't mean he's influencing it. That stuff, you can go around in your head for hours and hours and hours about that. But I never really thought about that. That's so great, because Spock, you know, he's from the future, so he knows the quote unquote destinies of Kirk and you know, his younger self. He puts Kirk in the position to meet his younger self, and they can forge that friendship together, because if he had been there the whole time, he would not have learned what he needed to learn. And that is exactly why we go through the trials and tribulations that we do in this world, right? And it's because people say, why doesn't God just step in and do this and step in and do that, right? Well, there is no substitute for experience when it comes to, you know, life and evolution as a character, as yourself, right? And that to me, I don't know, that again, that much like the Spock and Star Trek IV, the Spock Prime is the god figure and Star Trek IX was like, oh, brilliant. Well done, Kevin.
Well, and the other thing about Spock in that film, because I don't want to, I very want to be careful about, you know, carrying analogies and metaphors like too far, because they always break down at some point. And of course, especially when they're not intended. I don't want to read too much into things. But I think we can definitely say that Spock is acting on faith. And that Spock has always acted in faith, and he's learned over the years where to place his faith, because he used to be, I mean, you look at the Galileo 7, he puts his faith totally in logic and doesn't recognize the humanity and the human interest of the situation. And that's when he begins to put his faith somewhere other than just pure logic. Of course, he can explain it logically, he always can. then that's when he really comes into his own. And that's part of the dynamic of the character, so that when he encounters his younger self in the first Kelvin timeline film, he says, you know, in this instance, put aside logic and do what feels right. You know, he's saying there's more to life than logic, and that's reflecting again what he says in Star Trek VI. Logic is the beginning of wisdom, not the end. There's more to it than logic, and he starts to sort of embrace his humanity. And he is, and again, he's acting in that faith which he articulates in Star Trek VI as the faith that the universe will unfold as it should. And that idea that if I put Kirk and Spock together in the right roles, you know, with the right motivation, they will forge that friendship because it's destiny. There's an interesting moment in the audio commentary when J.J. Abrams says, I looked at the script and I talked to Bob and Alex about it, and I'm like, guys, come on. By the time they find Spock on the ice planet, I'm like, guys, this is ridiculous. How can this all just happen? You know? And he said the explanation they gave me was, it's destiny. And he said, oh, okay. That actually works. The idea is that whatever chaos is introduced, the destiny still works itself out. And to me, that was kind of a beautiful picture of sort of that relationship between free will and determinism, that the sovereignty of God means that the plan of God isn't about every little thing going exactly according to something that was predetermined. But that no matter what chaos happens, the will of God absorbs that into its matrix, just as the universe itself is this harmony between chaos and cosmos, you know. And that, to me, that's kind of a beautiful thing about that film, and I love it. But I didn't love Into Darkness.
I noticed that you didn't spend too much time on Into Darkness.
Well, I
saw a couple of sly maybe inferences that you're not the biggest fan in your writing there.
You know, we often have that relationship with things that we may not otherwise like all that much, but there may actually be value there. And sometimes we just kind of have to get over ourselves and look for goodness in things and in other people. And, you know, that's what I did with Into Darkness, and it made for a, I think, a pretty decent chapter.
Putting faith into practice, Kevin, for sure.
trying, yeah.
Well, the one thing you didn't touch on in the book, and something that I was curious about, was Khan's healing blood, and if there could be a connection there between, you know, the blood of Jesus, you know, the washy white as snow purifying blood. I mean, I'm sure somewhere in your mind you made that connection, but I was curious, you didn't really delve into it at all, and if you had any thoughts on that.
It's a stretch, Zach.
You know, I thought about it, because whenever I see someone saved by blood, I think, oh, hey. But I was like, but it's Khan's blood, and it's dumb.
You know, that's it right there. It's dumb.
You know, and I was just like, yeah, right. Right.
By the time I got to the end of this book, though, Kevin, you had me like connecting all these dots I never thought of before. And then I'm like, oh, Into Darkness. Oh, I'm sure. Oh, he juked me. He didn't do it. He didn't go where I thought he was going to go. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, and that's the thing, is that I really, the things that I pull out in this, you know, some of this metaphorical stuff, this allegorical stuff or whatever in some of these movies, you know, it looks like I have worked really hard to tease this stuff out and just to try to find it wherever I can. But the truth of it is, it just kind of kept finding me. And I just kept writing about it as long as I felt like it was honestly expressing something that I discovered that meant something to me. And when it got to the point where I felt like I was maybe trying too hard to make something out of it, when it wasn't presenting itself to me, then I was like, you know, we're just not going to go down that road. You know, there are things in Star Trek 2 that I didn't say, you know, and I didn't talk about, because I was like, okay, now you're just being ridiculous.
Now you flipped a switch in my head, man. I see it everywhere now in Star Trek. So
well, good. Well, you know, part of what I'm doing with that, though, part of what I'm doing, I mean, that's intentional, because it's expressing something that I've gone through in my life. If I can look at something like Star Trek and I can find things that comport with my faith and or that inspire me or that deepen my life and deepen my faith or whatever, then maybe I can find those things elsewhere too. And I think we can expand it to other disciplines, other ideas, other, you know, maybe you're doing work that you don't like, you know, but can you find the value in it for how you're serving other people through it? And can you find a way that you can become a better person through it? You know, can you find value in these things? And as we find value in the things in life, and I know this is big and just kind of grandiose and epic, you know, when we're talking about Star Trek, you know, but as we find the value in things in life and look for the best in stuff and in movies and in whatever else we're finding, maybe we can start to look for the best in each other too. And it's so easy to make an enemy of somebody we disagree with. It's so easy, particularly in our current cultural context. And even the smallest thing that unites us in any way as human beings with one another is a start for transitioning, like I said earlier, from a confrontation to a conversation. And even if we don't agree at the end of that conversation, we can at least respect each other's humanity and work toward the common goals we all have as human beings. And that's incredibly important.
Well, well said, sir. You know, Ken and I, you know, we always try to keep it pretty light here on Standard Over, and this is probably one of our most meaningful and intellectual deep discussions we've had in our time in the center seat here. But I have very much enjoyed it.
Yeah, you know, for me, I apologize for not interjecting a lot, because a lot of the things you were saying just needed to be digested. And I'm one of those people that it's okay, I really need to think about what's being said here. And I can't wait to kind of to replay this whole thing, because when you hear it as it goes, well, there's a lot to it. And There really is. And it comes down to a couple of things for me, Kevin. You know, being a fan of Star Trek for many, many years, and, you know, we talk to people and fans, and we kind of talked to this not that long ago, Zach and I did, not so deeply, but how, and Nick Anastasio was on the show, and we were talking about how, you know, people have found not their salvation, but their safe space in Star Trek. You know, that place where they can find others that you know. Let's face it, back in the day, especially in my day, you were teased pretty hard if you were a Star Trek fan. And, you know, now it's more of a fun type of tease or whatnot, but it's still rough. But it was the one spot that, and it was something I even noticed when I was in Las Vegas last year, and that is, it's all inclusive, and there are people from all walks, all races, all religions that are coming together, and it kind of I guess brings to life a lot of the things that you're saying, and that is, you know, there's hope, there's faith, there's trust, there's joy, there's a lot of things, and it's funny that a quirky 1960s TV show has evolved into something like that. In a sense, it's almost become its own religion. Not with the rules and regulations, because the fan opinions and things and how they look at each series is can be vastly different. But to me, that is the one thing that I loved and why I fell in love with Star Trek. And it mirrors everything you're saying in this, as far as faith, forgiveness, joy, acceptance, not being judgmental, all those things. When I walk around, I just see so many people, and you know, they're into it, because nobody, you can go to a Star Trek convention, it doesn't matter what you look like, what you're dressed up as, you're welcome. You know, here you go. This is, you know, and it was almost, and if somebody should go against that or anything along those lines, they'd have a ton of Trekkers telling them where they can go find themselves, because that kind of behavior is not accepted. And I think that's a unique piece of the fandom here. And I definitely see the parallels in what you're saying. And it's been a very thought-provoking conversation, and I thank you for that.
Thank you. And I appreciate you saying that greatly. And I concur. And I really, you know, I think the first time I went to like a Star Trek meeting or gathering of any kind, I was like, wow, there's a lot of weirdos around here, you know, and I love that. I love that. That excites me, because, you know, I was always, you know, one of the weird kids, you know, growing up, and it's just cool that there's space for people, and I find that to be a beautiful picture of a more hopeful vision of our society and of our culture. That we can have those kinds of conversations. You know, when I post this stuff on when I posted like announcing this book in some Star Trek groups, you know, I get some pushback. You know, every now and again, somebody would comment and say, you know, rah, 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 that's not what Star Trek's about, you know. But then I found that I could explain myself to them, and we'd end up having a very nice dialogue about it, you know, and a very nice little conversation. Come away going, oh, okay, wow, hey, we can respect one another. And I like that, and I want to see more of that in our world and our culture. And if I can do the smallest thing to push us in that direction, I'd like to. It's a hard time for us, because our ability to talk at each other has grown so greatly and so quickly. I did a book recently. I co-edited a book with a friend of mine called Science Fiction and the Abolition of Man, taking C.S. Lewis's book, The Abolition of Man, and putting it in conversation with science fiction, television, and film. And it's a multi-author work. And a lot of what we talk about that in there is our relationship to technology. And one of the things that I talk about with that in relationship with Star Trek in that book is that when our technological advancements outpace our moral and our ethical advancements, that's when we get into trouble. And our relationship to technology. It's not that technology is good or technology is bad. It's a tool, but it can get out of hand with us. And we're at that point where I think certain things are kind of slipping out of our grasp. And if we don't engage thoughtfully in how we communicate with one another in this age of communication, then we're in danger of losing our own humanity. And that's something that I think in Star Trek is the ultimate worst thing. And it's probably really the worst thing from a Christian perspective too, because again, our humanity was created in the image and likeness of God. And just like Data is created in the image of his father, we're created in the image of God. And if we pursue deeply what it means to be human, then we'll find the source and the aim of that humanity. And if we spend all our time shouting at each other, we'll never get there.
So eloquently said, Kevin. I almost feel I feel bad about adding anything to the end of that. To touch on that real quick. Yeah, I think, you know, there's nothing more dangerous than a false sense of community and connection.
Yes.
And I feel like that is what we're falling into these days with, like, our, you know, always plugging into our phones. I'm so guilty of it, right? I'm just on my phone all the time, and you're like, oh, hey, I'm plugged in, I'm this and that. Yeah, you're plugged in, but are you really connected to people, right? And it just, and you know, to jump the time stream here to your next book, The Borg, right? They're the exhibit A of that. So I'm sure you'll have some interesting things to say about that when you dive into that. But you know, finally, with your book here, man, I really enjoyed it. I found the part about, you know, reconciling Star Trek's humanism with, you know, Christianity's view of humanity was really spoke to me, and it really struck a chord. And then, as someone who's obviously watched Star Trek his whole life and continues to watch Star Trek and does a Star Trek podcast, it was great to get some new perspectives on things that have been around for so long, and that it's kind of fires off the brain cells. Like I said, you flip that switch, man, I'm going to be seeing those connections. Star Trek is, and more Star Trek as I keep watching. I'm really looking forward to you continuing this book series for sure.
Thank you very much, sir, and I'm looking forward to it too. One note I would add for your listeners is that there is a chapter on Star Trek Beyond. It's actually the longest chapter in the book, so we didn't cover it in our conversation, but it's there, and I really like it because I love that movie.
Yes, we're all fans of Beyond here on Center Orbit.
Yes, yes. So, and Ken, maybe we'll have a follow up episode where we can discuss all of your musings after listening back to this episode.
Well, listening and getting my my opportunity to read this and then the follow on book. It's definitely it's obviously there's a lot here, and you know, I felt the same way after listening to your interview on Metatrex. I thought it was really interesting, and you know, of course those guys, you know, besides needing a dictionary to translate half the words they use, you get so much out of it. So no, I appreciate you coming on. It was a real honor and a pleasure to talk through this, and you know, and I hope our listeners you know, really get the gist of what this episode was about. It really is about acceptance, and you know, I guess it circles back to my first question about redeeming that balance between humanism and Christian's view of humanity. And that's where it kind of all started. And I think that you know, I think the key is, no matter what you believe in this uniform, in this universe here, you're welcome. And there is a absolute fundamental feeling that if you have strong Christian beliefs, there's a lot of good things here to pull from and draw from, and you shouldn't be afraid. At least this is what I'm hearing from you guys, anyway. More than anything, you shouldn't be afraid to be outward about it. And I think a lot of people pull it inward when it comes to Star Trek a lot of times because of the constant, well, it's an atheistic, humanistic spot, you know. But you know, there's probably a lot of people kind of behind the curtain going, well, that's not how I feel, but. Because the ultimate objective of all of this is to love and accept one another, I'll just put it in the corner. And you know, I think what this book does is help those who have done that feel more confident in coming out with it. And that's an absolutely beautiful thing.
Thank you very much. And I tell you, it's been a real honor to be on the show, and I appreciate you guys letting me ramble and exploring all this stuff, because it's a great, rich, beautiful, fun journey, and it's one that, you know, it extends to Star Trek and beyond.
Well, Kevin, thanks again for taking the time to talk to us today about your book and also your other Star Trek fandom and experiences. If people want to find you online and keep track of your work or your book or book you to speak, you know, where can they find you?
So my website is kevincnees.com. Nees is spelled N-E-E-C-E. And you can also go to gospelaccordingtostartrek.com. on discoveredcountryproject.com. That'll all kind of take you to the same hub. And you can sign up for the email list there, which will actually give you a really healthy sample of the book, particularly that Roddenberry section that we talked about in the introduction and some other things. And find out what I'm doing, and you can book me to speak there, and you can follow me on Twitter, Facebook, and all those good things. And love to keep in touch with you. Love to hear questions. Love to engage in conversation, and love to come out and speak for you wherever you are.
Awesome. Thanks again. Well, the gospel according to Star Trek isn't the only thing we've been discussing this week on Trek FM. Here's a quick look at what else you might have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Melodic Treks.
He wrote very heartfelt music for masculine subjects. And if you look at his career, whether it's Red October, where I don't think there's a woman with a speaking part, I mean, it's like an all-male movie, or RoboCop, or Conan, or Flesh and Blood. And those were, you know, about like old-fashioned, traditional, manly men, you know, and what's in the heart of those warriors.
Literary Treks.
McCoy eventually gets command of the Enterprise, and one of the reasons for this is that he makes little comments to Kirk occasionally about how he has a cushy job. You know, he's got, oh, this nice comfortable chair he can sit in, because McCoy at this point, he's got a lot of people getting sick on the Enterprise. There's colds, there's broken legs or whatever. I mean, there's just, for some reason, sick bay is busy.
Stage 9, a podcast about the people who make Star Trek.
The thing that finally pushed me over the edge. This is going to sound so stupid. I've said this before. They were releasing a Superman versus Aliens comic book. And I was like, oh, I guess I better get ready for Superman versus Aliens and watch, you know, the Alien movies.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, get the show on iTunes or the Apple Podcasts app. Be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, Speaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well.
If you'd like to get in touch with us here at Trek FM, you can always find us on trekfm.com/contact. And look in the sidebar on the show page, or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm, and please leave us a voice message. You can also contact us through Twitter at trekfm, or on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, and of course in the Babel Conference. Type Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trekfm and click discussion on the menu bar. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron on the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find the current goals and different milestone contributions along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details on patreon.com/TrekFM. Speaking of Patreon, thank you as always to our great associate producers for Standard Orbit. We have Renee Roberts, Norman Lau, Aaron Harvey, Tim Robertson, Nick Anastasio, Richard Marquez, and Corey Elrod.
Yes, thank you guys so much for your support for both Standard Orbit and Trek FM. So Ken, if people want to find you out there on the internet, where can they find you?
You can find me hanging around the Babel Conference and engaging people when I have the opportunity. You can also find me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @BostonSCPO, and we like to tweet out all our new episode information as soon as we get it, as well as our colleagues. So look for me there.
As for me, you can find me on Twitter @MoronZach. That's MoreonZach. And I'm also the host of my own podcast, Always Hold On to Smallville, where we talk about each and every episode of that Young Superman series from the early 2000s. And you can find us on Twitter @AlwaysMallville with one S. So thanks everyone for listening, and join us again next time here on Trek FM for another episode of Standard Orbit.